Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
The World Atlas of Cheese by Nancy Urquhart Stork, Episode 3. So I've done the first two episodes where we've looked at the historical origin of cheese, some of the making of cheese, general idea of making cheese, how it's the way is separated, and there's bacterial cultures which increase the acidity of it and make it eventually sterile and salty. Adds the flavour, there's different moulds and textures and ripening of the cheese, preparation of the cheese. Now we're up to the classification of cheese. So last night I did what possibly is a 2-hour podcast as I walked this long path. So really pushing myself basically on the nature of social conception of society as opposed to information conception of society, to deal with failure and things like that. However, we're going to go into the classification of cheeses. I sort of like it. Cheese is such an amazing thing that people can actually talk about and think about it. It's a pretty amazing thing. The world of cheese, with overwhelming variety of types, is almost impossible to classify. Many countries supply their own systems, coupled to legal conditions. What goes for one country does not necessarily go for another. A national cheese sometimes has to meet different requirements in another country and get another classification. This book tries, in a data panel at the end of each country's chapter, to classify the different aspects of the country's most important cheeses. There's these areas, I suppose, A, B, C, or if you've got H categories, and how you classify it. Okay, A. So this category A. So it's sort of like a 10-dimensional cheese space they're talking about. A, the milk used is the very obvious criteria. Cow's milk is the most common. With a little practice, you will soon recognize other milks by their typical flavor. We indicate these different milks as follows. There's a cow with a cow's head, goat with a goat's head, sheep like a sheep. Refers to note at the foot of the data panel if it doesn't go those things. Well, a goat doesn't look like anything. A sheep, a cow, you can tell. B. So that's A. I mentioned B. The International Dairy Federation has made a classification which is useful because it appeals to the non-technical cheese amateur. Like myself, a non-technical cheese amateur. That's like the majority of you people out there in Urquhart's world. Its classification is the type of consistency. This consistency is determined by proportion of dry matter, proteins, milk sugar, and minerals to moisture. Less moisture the cheese contains, the harder it is. Difficulty is that the ratio is never constant, but changes as the cheese gets older. You can call a mature semi-hard cheese hard, and still the same cheese even young is soft. Still, it's an easy look at Michael's characteristics. Look at these examples. The Schbrinz, S-B-R-I-N-Z. Well, that's, I'm going to use something for word source, contains 65% dry matter and 35% moisture. Romico contains 40% dry matter and 60% moisture. And the Spiegelquark, which is like for some of that, contains 20% dry matter and 80% moisture. According to consistency, we distinguish these four groups. Fresh cheeses, fromage frais, Spiegelquark, cream cheese, are not hardly ripened and can be eaten almost immediately. Soft cheese like Camembert, Limburg, Brianza, which stick to the knife and may be spreadable. Semi-hard cheese like Gouda, Stilton, Fontana, firm but smooth and easy to cut. Hard cheeses like Immortal, Schbrinz, Parmesan, hard to very hard, sometimes difficult to cut, but ideal to grate. That's B. You know, whether you can grate it. You can't grate cream cheese, I suppose. So, and they have different things. So, an empty circle, a full circle, and hard cheese is a solid square. And then, classification of the exterior to cheese rind. So this is a 3-dimensional space. is another method easily employed for the non-expert. There's no rind, or hardly any rind. This is the case amongst others of most fresh cheeses, dry rind. This is a natural crust that develops during ripening under normal conditions. White mold flora on the surface, orange mold smear washed cheeses, and then blue vein cheeses. You've got the various symbols. So there. And so now, we've done ABC, we're into the fourth dimension. So this is space-time. We're going to beat the standard quantum mechanics soon. Another criteria is the fat content. This is calculated according to the percentage of fat in the dry matter of the cheese. For example, if the fat content is 50%, the total dry matter is 40%. That means 100 parts of the cheese contains 20 parts of fat, 40 parts of dry matter, 60 parts water. For example, I'm going to read that. If the fat content is 50% and the dry content is 40%, okay, so the fat is within the dry content, I suppose. So it's 50%, so it's, this content is expressed as a percentage of the dry matter because a cheese, when it gets older, loses the moisture, would otherwise have a continuously changing percentage. So fat is inside, so... Some countries indicate fat content should be a symbol plus, 48 plus, because the percentage is a minimum requirement. The actual fat content may be higher. The categories mentioned under A, B, C or D are easiest and the most useful way to differentiate many cheeses of the world. These classifications can be found in data panels. Cheese, however, can always also be grouped in other ways. So pan-dimensional cheese. Okay, so fat content. That's interesting. I think you should know about that. Preparation of cheese can vary greatly. There are countless recipes and variation of recipes. We have illustrated these details in the detail of the modern factory production of five representative cheese types. Most popular cheeses are made according to one of these main methods. Emmental production, representing hard cheeses with heated, cooked and pressed curd. Oh, that's cheddar cheese production, representing hard cheese which are cheddared and pressed and curd. Well, I think when I first read of this, I knew the cheddar process, but I now know this is an Emmental process. Gouda production, representing semi-hard pressed cheeses. Camembert, representing unpressed cheese and without a rind flora. Cottage cheese production, representing fresh cheese. Now that's six. Different types, different from these types are six plastic curd, or kneaded cheeses, for which the curd is immersed in hot water and kneaded. Colorful cone. Whey cheeses, for which the whey is boiled down. Or an albumen cheese, for which the milk proteins are made to flocculate by heating. Oh, so albumen is the egg white, is these globular molecules. I really would like to actually know the actual molecules here. It's interesting about the calcium and the rennet and the casein, and how the molecule is turned into water, soluble molecule, changes the water interaction. Okay, now there's F, the curdling method. A division can be made between curdling with the aid of rennet, most cheeses, and curdling without rennet, but only with sour milk. The sour milchshakes. That's a German with a diuresis over the A. G, a division is possible in the ripening methods. Long or short ripened under moist or dry conditions, resulting in large, medium or small or no holes. So, yes, I wonder how that happens. Finally, there's a difference in the shape and weight of cheeses. Although this says little about the quality, we've included these features in the data panels as they help in recognising the cheese. Finally, we must mention processed cheese, which is made from a base of natural cheese and is manufactured by a very different production method. In this book, the emphasis is very much on natural cheeses of each country. There's a separate section on processed cheese beginning on page 227. Oh my god. you can't, just to tell you, you can't have cottage cheese, has no rind, and is always soft. I sort of like, it's like a multidimensional thing, but it's not. However, so you can have, you can have, what is it, a dry rind in all, cheese, Calipari, Gouda, and Cheddar. You can have a white mold flora on everyone. Every cheese except cottage cheese. But you can't have blue vein hard cheese. Which is amazing, interesting. Oh, there's this person looking at the cheese. Cheese and the senses. Sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch are the five essential, essentials that give life a real dimensions. And you can actually listen to cheese. This is the person who I like is the person with this cheese hammer, tapping the cheese and listening to the cheese. be really interesting to put MRI. Okay. When Shakespeare wrote, "The air nimbly and sweetly recommends itself to our gentle senses," he could have been a cheese expert talking about cheeses, not a poet writing about castles. These cheeses experts needs all the senses about him, but professionals do not have to be the only ones to use their senses to make sound judgments about cheeses. As a layman, you too can do a good job if you know what to look for and how to go about it. Judging a cheese. For a start, it's a good idea to take a close look at the cheese. Its appearance is often a giveaway. The cheeses should be well shaped, neither bulgy nor too flat or too thick. A smooth, well sealed rind without cracks or cloth creases shows that it's been carefully produced. Some cheeses have rind flora, and this should be evenly distributed, free of any colouring that is not expected in a particular cheese type. The cheese paste itself should have no mould, unless, of course, it is blue cheese. It should have a fresh colour, varying from white to light cream to ochre yellow, according to the variety. The cutting surface should be unbroken. Cracks indicate faulty production and storage. Cheese, of course, cannot speak. Oh, that my cheeses do. My cheeses speak to me frequently. I've really been able to unsettle people, saying, oh, the pot plants in here have got a real mouth in them, but only when you turn your back, they're just sure as totally mad. But they can express themselves as the cheese expert listens. He takes a hard or semi-hard cheese in his hand, holds it to his ear, taps it with his hand or fist or a special hammer, and listens. A hollow answer indicates open texture with too many holes, a dead sound or blind body of hard many eyes and holes. He can make a judgment about whether it has too few or too many, or not, or just enough holes, whether many or just so, whether they are properly distributed over the body or whether they are too large or too small. An instrument called a cheese trier, or cheese iron, is used, is pushed into the cheese, and the boring tested. Is the trier well filled with cheese? Does the cheese look springy? Are there any holes? Are there the sort of questions that these are the sort of questions the expert asks. Taste and smell. But it is after the cheese trier is removed, the cheese is cut, that the next sensory experience begins. So you observe. I think it's sort of an intellectual, like seeing an old friend, I suppose. The aroma is released. No, cheese. There are six basic aromas. Okay, remember this one, because we'll be asked about it. Fruity, flowery, resinous, spicy, foul or burnt. I like a burnt, foul cheese. These rather fancy terms are seldom used by the expert. He has his own jargon. He finds the cheese aromas either good, fresh, sweet, or sour. Sometimes mold, gassy, or tainted with ammonia. None of which means necessarily that the cheese is below standard. It could be a characteristic of the variety. One thing that must be there is aroma of a particular milk that has been used. The cow, the goat, sheep, all have their unique aroma. A full aroma is not actually released until the cheese has been brought to room temperature. Consequently, the consumer gets a full benefit. The expert often tests the cheese in cold storage, and it develops a sense of smell and has acquired knowledge to make a sound judgment. Taste invariably follows smell. It's a combination of taste and smell that gives the gustatory sensation. There are four basic flavors. Well, we now know there's five, which is umami, sweet, salt, sour, and bitter. When this cheese is finely divided in the mouth, coming into contact with the entire surface of the tongue, the aroma is fully released to the senses. The memory stores the experience, ready for future acceptance or rejection. It's become a personal matter outside the practical judgment of the experts. Soft varieties of cheese are often judged in the first place by touch. This is the resilience of the body checked by pinching. The shopper can do this before buying, checking whether it's firm, pliant, or soft. So, is to say, unripe or well ripened. If the body of a soft cheese can be pressed out of the rind, it's excellent quality. For the consumer, it's hardly possible to go into a supermarket and carry out the sensory test. Oh, I do. So I just say, rack off, I'm a cheese expert. And then take it up to management and I slam my book of Urquhart stalk and say, take me away, book me. I stand for cheese. Okay. If it were no doubt what is now called a private cheese party, we'd get a public counterpart causing no end of problems for both the storekeepers and those of the public who are less partial to the dubious delicious food stuff. See, that's sorry, Urquhart, exactly my point. What? My godfather, there's something really weird here. It is sympathies that will allow you to handle cheeses and will be pleased to discuss them with you. Not nowadays, mate. In that case, you're lucky and you should learn what you can. Make sure that the consumer gets what he expects. Most countries have a grading and supervision systems. Cheeses are graded and classified and given a marking that tells the origin, fat content, and type. The quality of the cheese is carefully checked. Cheese is a living thing. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching are sensory perceptions that make life a total experience. Cheese is more than almost any other edible commodity. It demands the use of all these senses. If proper judgments are to be made about the qualities and applications, cheese, by its very character, a product produced by organic processes aided by human expertise demands, like wine, the awareness of the artist coupled to, at least, a rudimentary knowledge if it is to be adequately assessed and fully appreciated. To be a professional cheese judge takes years of training and experience. To be a layman with the knowledge of cheese takes a natural liking of the commodity, plus curiosity, feeling, perhaps a desire for surprises, and the five senses that are eager and well-developed. So there's various diagrams of the mucous membrane of the nose, the ocular cells detailed below, that discerns smells for the cheese. Then they've got what I now recognise as the different taste buds. These are the islet taste buds. I have to go back and redo what the different taste buds are. There's a whole lot going in here. But left, a detail of the tongue's differently shaped papilla. This is these little sensory glands. Far left, the tongue sends taste impulses from from various areas to the brain. And this is just a 1970s picture of the brain. This is beautiful. These graphics are pre-computer graphics. I have to really go back over taste. I sort of remember it, but I have to go across. Okay, we're now on to quality control. That was worthwhile. It's worthwhile reading. And the great thing about forgetting things, you read it and forget it, is it can draw it time and time again. It's like, you no longer have to get a big film library. You can watch the same film over and over again. Quality control. Nearly all countries with an important cheese production have a legal regulation and controls. Cheese is defined in precise terms, and the regulations are laid down for the production of the various types. These regulations show great differences from country to country. As far as the milk is concerned, there is usually regulations about what animals may supply the milk for a given cheese. A milk must be hygienically obtained and, of course, free of germs. Sometimes the maximum acid level is prescribed, as well as the last acceptable time that milk can be delivered to the cheese factory. Most countries make cheeses with different fat contents. German even has 8 classes of less than 10% to 60%. For many cheeses, minimum fat contents have been established that must be observed. The fat contents should be stated on the cheese itself or on the package. As far as the preparation is concerned, most countries restrict themselves to general regulations about the correct fat and moisture content of cheeses. However, there are some countries which prescribe special preparation methods. In every country, attention is paid to additives. Subcultures' remnants must be examined regularly for microorganisms. Sometimes it is stated that it may not be made from calf, stomach. Sometimes other remnants indicated by their names are allowed. Additions like herbs, spices, are often described and indicated on what cheeses they may be used in. Almost every country states exactly what chemicals may be used and what is the maximum amount allowed. Coverings like wax, paraffin, plastic oils are also dealt with. The cheese-making rooms in most countries must meet special requirements of size, technical installation, cleanliness, and so on. Even the staff must meet certain requirements as far as health and hygiene are concerned. The ripening is a statutory in various countries. A minimum time is indicated in Canada, for example, and the ripening temperature For the moment, the Netherlands is still the only country with regulations for cheese ripened in foil, and France for pre-packed cheese. Apart from cheese in general, cheese groups have also statutory definitions, e.g. hard, semi-hard cheese, soft cheese, fresh cheese. Generally, the water content in fat-free cheese mass is taken as standard. Specialties like Schauer, Milchkäse, or whey cheese are also bound to statutory regulations. How supervision of statutory regulations is to be carried out is also determined by the lawmakers. The law, cheese law. Here's Interpol. Sorry, I only do cheese. I'm only a cheese policeman. That sort of reminds me of the military police. How the supervision of statutory regulations is carried out is also determined by lawmakers. The inspectors are neither exclusively inspectors or professional experts, like cheese tracers or cheese technicians commissioned by controlling authority. There are countries that have judging systems for quality using with a point evaluation to determine in what quality class a cheese belongs. During the Stresser Convention in 1951, I'm not going to quote, if I'm ever captured, I'm not going to quote the Geneva Convention, I'm going to quote the Stresser Convention. The first international agreements were fixed between 9 countries. The names of particular cheeses were rejected for the areas of origin. This made it difficult for imitations to be offered to the real thing. For instance, Roquefort, the municipalities where it can be made, were precisely stated, as well as Bleu du Haut-Jura, The latter cheese must be produced above 800 metres. The milk must be made over 800 metres. Surely the factory can be down at sea level, but let's go. Comte cheese must be made in the province of Comte, and only from milk of cows from the breed of Pie Rouge de l'Est or Morbillier, whose milk must be delivered after each milking. For Catel, the pastures must also be located above 800 metres. Palmingo, of which the area's preparation is also exactly indicated, may only be made between April the 15th and November the 11th, and must ripen for at least two summers. Pirico Silanco may only be made in Sicily from fresh sheep milk between October and June. In 1967, a code of quality standards for the Stress Convention. In 1967, a code quality standards was fixed thanks to the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and WHO, World Health Organization, for 5.3 million tons of cheese made yearly by 33 countries. There are countries which produce less than 100,000 tons yearly, but 17 countries supply 87% of the world's cheese production. Damn, I knew there was a cheese hierarchy out there. The aim of the code principles set up by the organization is to forbid the use of misleading names and descriptions on non-dairy products, so they cannot be mistaken for dairy products. It also gives international standards for cheese in general, and a number of specific cheeses. Some of these recommendations are already being accepted by the governments and countries concerned. The purpose of all this is to protect cheese trade and the consumer against dishonesty. You know, that really goes. I don't mind being ripped off. I don't mind corruption. But I want to eat a proper cheese. I don't want a cheese made in Fiji saying it's coming from, you know, Canada or something like that. Law regulations may have a negative impression, but here they show that the authorities are concerned with the value of money and the giving the consumer the cheese that he asks for. I want my cheese, and I want it now. France, Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Italy, Norway, Sweden, and Switzerland, in the 1951 agreement, the Stresser Agreement, was concluded giving international protection to the names of a number of well-known cheeses. The following groups were established. Group A. The names Roquefort, Pirico, Romano, Parmigiano, Reggiano may only be used for cheese prepared in the original countries. Group B. The names Camembert, Brie, Saint-Paulin, Fontaine, Four, Solo, Eglis, Provence, Emmental, etc. Norway, blah, blah, blah. May be used for imitations prepared other countries on condition that the countries where the cheese is produced is indicated, i.e. Norwegian Gouda. Okay, that's not... Oh, with you. Oh, bloody hell, I wonder whether... We should say Australian Camembert. We say King Island Camembert. That's what we say. We don't say the country, we say King Island or Kangaroo Island. In general, we name it from a nice piece of Europeanish type of Australia. French cheeses and the French law, finally, may be useful to name French cheeses that have their names protected by French law. This means that they may be imitated abroad, but if you buy French cheeses with this name, may be sure that it's original, genuine, and made according to the regulations applicable. Beaufort, Bleu, Beau Glaces, Beau Hojara, Guy de Comte, from the canal, Marouz, Musta, Neuchâtel, Pont-l'Évêque, Reblecon, Roquefort, and Saint-Nectaire. So, Australian cheese. Oh, look. The world of cheese. You've got the Soviet Union, China. India's producing nil or unknown. India just produce no cheese. New Zealand produces a fair amount of cheese. Sudan produces cheese. Egypt some cheese. Oh, Egypt's got that famous panda brand cheese. Right. The map shows the cheese countries of the world classified by four categories according to their national production figures. Australia's thumping cheese country. My godfather. Brazil's up there, but Argentina's whipping their ass. But we're beating Chile and Colombia. We're not on a par with Mexico. And we're beating Cuba and, dare say, we're holding our own against Iceland and Portugal and Burma. This is a slightly older map here. Japan. We're on the same level as Japan. Whereas Russia. Is Russia and Canada. It's a real Cold War. A world of surprises. Not only is the infinite variety of taste and smell, but in facts and figures too. Just look at the production, export and consumption data on these pages. For example, the United States is the biggest cheese producer in the world, but it hardly exports at all. Netherlands, as small as it is the biggest exporter. New Zealand exports almost all its cheese. Do they keep anything for themselves? One wonders. Oh no. Others eat their own cheeses and export relatively little, e.g. France, the Greek and French have the biggest consumption per head of population, while Japanese... Yes, hun? It often looks contradictory, but not when the facts are considered. Size of population, geographic, climatic conditions and history all have an influence. There are large areas where little or... world of cheese. Oh my god. Here's cheese statistics put to you. Oh, in the most disconcerting graph I've ever seen. It's a tube graph. No cheese is made. In the chapter on the history of cheese making, we have tried to find reasons why. You should remember, however, that nowadays, in many countries, some cheese is, in many countries, some cheeses may be made, but not commercially, in such small quantities that it is not yet recorded. We may have some cheese surprises to come. Now that transportation and storage difficulties can largely be overcome, cheeses that for so long have only been regional significance can be carried all over the world, even from landlocked countries that 100 years ago were unknown as international cheese producers. This can be seen as the rising cheese production export figures from certain countries. Another indication is the wide variety of cheeses to be found in shops today, a factor that shows that both the great availability and a growing interest in cheese as a food. Now, they've got a column graph showing that Greece gets 11 kilos per person in 1973, as opposed to Great Britain eats 5.8 kilos. And the bottom one shows total production. This is just the most disconcerting graph I've ever seen. It makes me actually seasick to look at it. World Atlas of Cheese, page 32. If you've got one, rush to it. And if you just want, you don't have to go hang gliding or parasailing or base jumping, you can just look at this graph, and it's just the most disconcerting graph. It makes you sick looking at it. Okay, well, not that sick, it isn't revolted. Total production, full column, and export, the lower column, in thousands of metric tons. So the Netherlands is a great exporter, Denmark's a great exporter, and New Zealand's just an outstanding exporter, but in terms of the greatest production of cheese is followed by the United States, closely followed by the Soviet Union. Soviet Union exports twice as much cheese as United States. Cold War, have to get on top of that. Okay, we're going to cover Europe. So it is an atlas, so let's go over different countries. Now this is Europe and above. Sturdy white, this is a picture for the Europe section. Sturdy white and black-faced cattle in a lush, well, they are white and black-faced. Well, okay, we've got little black pictures. They look like panda bears. Can I see a panda bear stuck on a cow's face? So, sturdy white and black faced cattle in a lush meadow promise plenty of wholesome milk for which good cheese can be made. Their promise, I dare to say, looking there, I cannot see an udder. These are not necessarily cattle. They're actually not cows. Well, they may make the promises and get the ladies to produce it. Okay, now here's a huge map of Europe. Dairy farming is right across the Pyrenees, right in central London, if you didn't know it was there. Dublin is in the centre of dairy farming. Iceland has got a lot of dairy farming around the edges. And look, I'm sure that cannot be true because there's snow-capped areas way up in Finland, way up in the Arctic Circle. There's big dairy farms. Moscow's got nothing except a big chunk. Russia's got, Soviet Union's got nothing except for a big chunk in the Caspian Sea near the Black Sea. We've got Gorl Czechoslovakia, which isn't there anymore. And key to symbols, this is strange, there's symbols off to the left, but no symbols on the actual map. So what does that mean? In the maps of Great Britain, Netherlands and France, Switzerland and Italy, the important original cheeses of each country have been marked by means of symbols representing their shapes and located in the region where each respective... So it is a cheese map, so it's an atlas, so it's not going to voice production, but there's the fresh cheese, dry rind, different rinds that should be in white Florida. It's got the general where you can blue vein, so you can actually see by a, there's an animal symbol, a type symbol, a rind symbol, and the actual geographic, geometric shape produced here. And you've got various maps, so you've got all of Europe broken up with the big water sources. Netherlands, for some reason, it's, water at the front is indicated as a big lake. She's expanded Holland Urquhart stalk. So there's great things, and I'm sure it's indicating lakes I've never seen before. Now, Cyprus has got one Crete. All of central Crete is dairy production. In fact, dairy production is just everywhere. Let's see if... Oh yes, there's the East and West Germany is still there. Paris is not a cheese producing place. Okay, now the form, the average weight is the usual forms of these cheeses were made and indicated. Okay, so I'm looking for to maps. Oh, okay, yeah, there are individual maps. England's got sort of various cheese put over Iceland. So left, fresh curd cheese, traditional stretching over 1,000 years. Iceland cheese. So England gets a map. Going ahead, so they're right, individual countries. So there's all this thing, but Norway. Oh my god, Father, I've just never seen, this is cheese, Jarlsberg cheese. Now, Jarlsberg cheese is actually, this would really put you off. It's Jarlsberg cheese, which I like so much. It's shown here, it's got afro of mold growing on top of it. Norway is a sparsely populated country, with a majority of people living in the south. This isolated church is situated on the northern coast. Okay, there's an isolated church, and it's just a church and nothing around. It's just complete 1970s blank. There's no cows in there. Below, farmhouses in the plateau of Green between Bergen and Trollheim. Here you might still find a farmhouse goat cheese. Okay, so I'll just read Norway and finish off this section. Oh...
it's, you know, reading it aloud is beautiful because you just read it and just go, if Scandinavia were like to a piece of cheese, then Norway might be resemble the rind, hard, irregular, and crumpled crust. Elongated stretch of land consists the most part of imposing but inhospitable plateau of some barren rock, some 70% of which is above the tree line. For over a million years, the Atlantic Ocean has flayed the Norwegian coast. The sea borders of the country in all directions save that of the east. It's just, gosh, that's amazing. Diving deep into fjords and fissures that were first cut by the retreating glaciers of the Ice Age. From early times, the Norwegians have made a virtue out of necessity. Turning to the ocean for livelihood, the seas are full of fish, was full of fish, and rugged coasts form many natural harbours for the ships built by a nation of master shipbuilders. Although the fishing industry has played an important part of Norway's economy, only a small proportion of Norway's is under cultivation. I'll just read that one again. Does that make sense? Although the fishing industry has played an important part in Norway's economy, only a small proportion of Norway is under cultivation. Okay, that's just a great sentence. The country thus has had to rely on foreign trade since the days of the Vikings. Oslo, Bergen, Trondheim were trading centres of the thriving even during the Middle Ages. The Norwegians exported timber, fish, and holds of returning ships, often contained cheeses brought from other lands. An earlier cheese type that dates from this period is still being made is a semi-hard spice cheese called Nokkenlost, which bears the name some resemblance to Jutz Leiden cheese. It used to carry the mark of St. Peter's Cross Keys, the arms of the city of Leiden, hence the name Nokken is the Norwegian word for key. So Norkel, so it's key cheese. That's interesting that we go back to Peter Hill, a Hungarian who went right up to the very northernmost part of Norway, northern, and found a Hungarian village there. So they spoke Hungarian, and he was just like, "What? No, this is not right." Norway is full of surprises, and this Jarlsberg cheese is just frightening. It's not. A row of Gammelost cheese is ripening. Mold regularly pressed the cheese by hand with a unique pungent aroma and taste. Gammel is a real contribution to the range of cheeses of the world. When it's patted down, that's because the mold is growing up. Only some 3% early farmhouse cheeses. Only some 3% of Norway can be successfully cultivated. Although the warm Gulf Stream influences the climate, even as far north as Lofoten region, the weather can be mild and the grass is excellent quality. Yeah, I do think Erkhoff stork is actually a cow. I mean, not the demeaning cow, but an actual cow. Until the beginning of the 12th century, the introduction of hydroelectric power, Norway is almost entirely agriculture. A source of cheap power, electricity, brought about a growth of manufacturing industries, especially pulp, paper, wood, and canning industries. Okay, Norway's pasture land, albeit limited acreage, provides good grazing for cattle. Consequently, cattle breeding and dairying have made a substantial contribution to the national economy for centuries. The early farmers quickly learnt how to make the best of their dairy products. They found that skim milk left behind after the butter had been made could be used to produce delicious cheese. It's interesting, so you get the, you would think that butter would go to cheese, but butter's made for the really fat content and the remainder is cheese, so cheese is not such a bad thing. Cheesemakers used beautifully carved and decorated cheese molds for transplanting their cheese and butter. There was a traditional tine T-I-N-E, a striking shaped elegant wood container. This, the symbol of this container, rendered in national red colours, red, white and blue, is today the emblem of the entire Norwegian dairy industry. Although Norway has many farms, they are among the smallest in Europe, and in past time the cheese producing per family was not very high. Much of the cheese was made for immediate consumption and eaten fresh. Pultlost, a non-fat cheese made of sour skim milk, is an early cheese type produced long before the arrival of manufactured cheeses. This tough cheese is made throughout Norway, and there is a seemingly endless variety with only slight differences in preparation. Some might contain caraway seeds, others had cream added to make them a cheese richer. Pultos is also known as a Ramlos and Knost, according to the locality. When you consider Norway's mountainous character, it's not surprising that goat was once as popular, if not more so, than cow's milk. The two were frequently mixed to give a variety of taste. The taste is for sharp, pungent cheese remains, and goat cheese is still made here on the farms, where the cheese is J-Holst. Farmer to factory. Even now, several farmers who still make cheese of their own consumption, but the production of the cheese for markets has long since moved from the small towns to the factories. The development of the factory industry started long ago in 1856. Farmers in some of the valleys decided to build communal farms in the mountains, with the cattle grazed during the summer months. The aim was to process the rich quality sun milk and move heralded the first cooperative dairy plant in Northern Europe. The issue was so well received that dairy factories began to appear everywhere throughout the country. Today, there's an impressive 200 or so cooperative establishments. You know, there's probably about three, and they're all owned by Japan, if I know anything. In keeping with the progressive approach to farming and cheese making, an improved road system was planned. Okay, so... Bugger, I'm not going to build a road right through the Norway. It's just get reindeer and mountains and fjords. But it's for cheese making. Oh, that changes everything. I'll go out and build, blast my way through the mountains. So it's cheese making. Roads were laid to farms, even those outlying properties in the mountains, so the transportation of milk and farm factory was fast and efficient. While the traditional origin of cheese formed the basis of their quality, the cooperative effort enabled mass production to get underway. Factories are now not only making Norway's standard cheese types, but new brands as well, including Norbo, Ridder, similar cheese to Sempelen, and an easy melting Radnes Norvegia, popular in the kitchen. Well, goodness. Like, you wouldn't... Oh, here's some hiking cheese. Oh, bit rubbery. What's it for? Well, you melt it in the kitchen. Oh, bugger that. I won't take it hiking. Also being produced is the blue Normana, Norwegian, Gouda and Edam and Tilsit. Porch Salute, Camembert, Brie and Emmental. And the glorious cream cheeses, Creme Chateau and Chateau Bleu. To mention but a few. The entire cheese production, its inspection and marketing, both at home and abroad, is controlled by the Norsk Mesker works together with the Ministry of Agriculture. Now, I was driving my daughter to work and I forgot the stressor. How can you forget the stressor convention? So he thought that history was due to the rise of dictators in Europe or fascism. No, my friend, is actually that cheese explains everything. A stressor convention came in after 1951, and then the world sort of breathed a relief, because it was really a secret war all about cheese. Cheese for the long winter. In addition to fresh cheeses, the dairy farmers used to make cheese that could be kept for eating during the long winter months, when milk was not so plentiful. As a rule, the cheeses were prepared during the summer from the milk surplus, so for the coming winter. It has been suggested that the unique brown cheeses called Gramalos owes its name to its long keeping properties. Gramal is a Norwegian word for old, while ost simply means cheese. myself that go, why not give cheese names? Ost. There's old cheese, and it's old cheese. It's again, if you've got an Urquhart stalk, go straight to page 37 and check out these hairy cheeses. They're just nightmares. Like a cheese. If you saw a cheese like this in the fridge, you'd throw it out right away. Okay. Is a cheese made from a very old recipe. So it's an old cheese from an old recipe. More likely explanation, however, is Scott's name because of the cheese appearance. Not only did it turn greenish-brown colour, but it developed a mould-grown as well. Whatever the origin, present factory-made Gramerl loss is already for consumption within 4 to 5 weeks. It's one of the freshest cheese, Norway's freshest cheese cheese. Well, I'm going to ask for some gremolos next time I go cheese hunting. The mold spores that settle on the gremolos endow it with a delicious flavour. In the dark days before sterilisation. Oh. Yeah. I don't understand why we've got this A, D and B, C. Why don't we just do P and post-sterilisation? And cheese making equipment. Farm cheeses grew spontaneously mold cultures. When cheese is made in a wooden vessel, molds, they were always traces remaining from the previous batch of mold spores, were extremely productive. This is considered unacceptable in hygienic modern factory. As a result, the spontaneous growth is now completely suppressed. However, the soft and smooth gremolos would not be gremolos without the unique distinctive flavour, sharp and aromatic. For this reason, to maintain character, the dairies inoculate the cheese with the laboratory grown molds. Once they had settled on the cheese, they developed a kind of long furry texture, a fur being pressed into a paste by hand and spread through the cheese, which slowly turns a brownish colour. Gremolos contains less than 3% fat. So it's a real diet cheese, and this cheese actually has this hair growing on it. Again, rush to your Urquhart stalk. I have a copy. If you want to, you can actually... Oh, it's Norway's got other pages. I was going to finish it off. Oh, this Gremolos. Well, go to supermarket Gremolos. If your library doesn't support an Urquhart stalk, the Urquhart stalk thing, just shout at the librarian. Go straight on, jump on the first Qantas flight, get up to Sydney, go up to the Blue Mountains, get up at Glenbrook, come up to my place, and I might have you let you have a look at my Urquhart stalk. Oh dear. And here's a table showing the milk is all of Mjost. You can see this is actually quite a good thing. You can see Bullis is a soft runless cheese. I can see made by a cow. This is great. Now Creme Chateau has no rind and it's a medium cheese. Hard cheese. Now this one has a Riddler cheese. You can see, this is the most brilliant Urquhart stalk. You are a genius. This is fantastic. Now that you've taught me the way of cheese, I can read your tables straight away. Okay, ancient revival. Norway gets several pages going to you. So it'll take us up to an hour. Ancient revival. Another true veteran amongst the Norway's cheeses is the Jarlsberg. I mean, can I say, Jarlsberg would be one of my favourite cheeses. It's got the bubbles in it. Its name derives from the oldest state west of the Bank Oslo Fjord in the south, where the Vikings first settled. Farmers in this region made a large, firm, full cream cheese with holes. Cheese more or less died out when the when attention first the cheese more or less died out when the attention shifted to the products of the dairy plants. But it was not totally forgotten. In the laboratories of the University of Agriculture in Ass. So there's a country, a place, there's the Angstrom, and there's a place, University of Agriculture in Ass, and it's the simplest town name I've ever seen. It's A-S. Experiments were continued until the correct method of preparing the original product was established. As the Norwegian taste had not changed over the ages, Jarlsberg once again became a popular cheese, both Norway's as well abroad. The taste is somewhere between a Gouda and the Emmental, mild and nutty with a slight hint of sweetness. Ah. So, gee, thank you for the University of Ass. Otherwise, Jarlsberg would just be no more. And look, the warehouse on the old harbour of Totten, situated on the fjord. Totten is one of Norway's main natural harbours. Okay, this is a picture. It doesn't show me where Jarlsberg is. My God, it looks pretty run down, the place. Okay, morning begins with my sost. So I know the ost means cheese and miss means something or other. Oh, here we go. The most popular Norwegian cheese is the home market, undoubtedly, is Meisost, a cheese made from whey. Meis is a Norwegian word for whey. So my whey cheese. It's all like tungsten. Oh, tungsten Swedish. What's that word for? Heavy stone. Stone. Tongue. It's heavy stone. Meisost is whey cheese. Okay. Without a piece of mysis on the table, Norwegian's breakfast is incomplete. More than 30% of the total cheese production consists of brown whey cheese, which is marketed in various forms. Whey cheeses, like skim milk cheeses, were originally products of expedients, but in Norway and other Scandinavian countries, their status has been considerably elevated. The whey cheeses types originated from goat's milk, because cow's milk was made into butter, and the whey was consistently deprived of butter fat. Goat's milk, on the other hand, was used only for drinking, or for cheese making. The whey cheeses were known as Gjetost, so I now know that ost means cheese, Gjetost, meaning Norwegian word for goat. Gjetost. Gee, this is boring. It's much more easy, and there's a similar, if you go to the Scandinavians, the periodic table is just the most uninspiring. I had four goes at naming one village, which is nothing, in the periodic table. I had four shots, the periodic table, sort of like a bad gallery. The manufacture of Meiost starts with either goat's milk or cow's milk, a mixture of both. And here you go, there's Meiost here. Meiost has got the two symbols here. It's not no rind, but it comes out as a medium cheese. Meiost is not, strictly speaking, a cheese, since cheese is, by definition, a product made from pressed curds. Well, that's, I was about to say that myself. Bloody hell. Oh, how about, sorry, I've skipped stuff. Manufactured Meiost starts with either goat's or milk's, a mixture of both. Made with pure goat's milk whey, and the product is called Elk Gjetost, means genuine Gjetost. The cream is skimmed for butter, and the milk goes to make cheese. The remaining whey is heated very slowly until the water is evaporated, and the milk forms a kind of brown caramelized base known as prim. At this stage, the milk cream is often added, which changes the fat content of the ultimate product. However, the brown colour, Swedish flavour, and firm, tough consistency is a general characteristic of Meiost, so it's basically like sugar coating. Meiost, strictly speaking, is not strictly speaking a cheese. That's one of the things I would actually say, but the Norwegians have put the ost next to it, and it's whey milk. It's a curd. So the whey comes off and the curd is left. They've broken the cheese rule. You've heard it here before. Erkoff knows this. I can mention meeting her in the 1975. I don't know if you ever get a picture of Erkoff's talk. About the author. Nancy Erkoff-Stork has been the head of the National Information Department of the Dutch Dairy Bureau in Rijswijk since 1956. A nutritious specializing in dairy products, she holds a domestic science degree in nutrition and was formerly a product development consultant with the Dutch dairy industry. She aided in the preparation of this book by more than 40 cheeses consultants and dairy associations throughout the world who have reviewed the text and illustrative material. Erkoff. Well, you'd be pretty old by now, Erkoff, but I wonder what you're doing now. There probably is a memorial to you somewhere. Okay. Dairymaid Mai Ost, which means whey cheese, the commercial variety, is still similar in quality to that of the original produced by mountain farms in former towns, and as a distant fast, must have been a real champion amongst Norwegian cheeses. It's even said that this was the cheese the Vikings carried with them as food as they went on their predatory raids, and from it they got their courage and endurance. Whatever the truth, their present descendants still consider Mayos an essential beginning of a busy day.
Well, see, you didn't know that the road system in Norway is to get cheese, and that the cheese fueled Viking fury. Okay, there you go. Food for hearty appetites. For centuries, Norwegian way of life demanded that the people independence, especially with regard to food supply. Foodstuffs had to be preserved during long winter months, especially in the isolated mountain farms' dwellings. For this reason, many of the Norwegians' traditional foods are smoked and salt-cured. Salt, mutton, salted ham, and salted fish. What about salted salt? Norway's cuisine can engender some fabulous thirsts. Hence the popularity of beer, the powerful aquavit. Today, Norwegian larder is supplemented by a variety of imported foods, but Norwegian's diet continues to remain simple, robust, filling and fresh. With fish as a staple food, the national menu consists of such delights as fish soup, hairy salt fish, pickled fish. Salmon is particularly delicious. There's also an abundance of roast lamb, veal, fine vegetables, crusty flatbreads, potato cakes, fruit, cream, buttermilk, and of course, cheese. Cheese especially goat, Gat Ost, means goat tree, or Mile Ost, whey cheese is used in sauces and on the famous open sandwiches. The impressive example of the French loaf cut lengthwise, well buttered and decorated with a selection of fish, meat, salad, cheese, according to taste. This arm's length sandwich is called a landgang, meaning gangway. Is best indulged in the preceded by a glass or two of aquavit, accompanied by Norway's favourite drink, beer. So aquavit, I don't know what that means. Norway's cuisine can engender some fabulous thirst. This has been really salty. Okay, we got on to Sweden. Sweden doesn't sound so... Oh my god, it's Father Christmas. Julost. Santa Claus features in this old cheese. At Christmas, Swedes enjoyed special... God... Joel Ost. God cheese? Okay, well, I'll get this out to you. This is the Irk of Stork signing off to you. From the 1970s, appreciated by one of the many people. And, of course, it's if you want to see Irk of Stork, you just simple press the internet, get on a Qantas flight, get down here, and... you have to come during daylight hours. You can, if you really want to, you can come up to the house at the night and ring the bell to see all this fabulous Irk of Stork stuff. This is, you know, I just can't get more into it. My god. The runic inscriptions were carved on rock surfaces. Runes played an important part of divination, where it's thought to have influenced the weather, crops, and cattle. Okay. And therefore cheese. Well, there you go. The cheese history of Europe. Europe was trying to work out. In fact, Britain, the big question is cheese. Was Brexit going to affect the cheese production in England? Thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.